This over there is a book. I made this Eminent Chemist series. You may have seen it. I don't know. But I made a transcript of everything that we said for 5 or 6 hours. And much of what I'll say today is already written that. And they, on the other hand, you see, intended to cut it down to a half hour and an hour program. And they are getting out a transcript of the hour program, you see. Yeah. But cutting that down to 1/6, you see. It might be that some of the stuff in there you want, I don't know. But yeah. I have a copy of it. You're perfectly willing to take it if the ACS will let you.
Oh, I think it will. I worked with Robert Johnson and Ken Chapman.
Oh, he did. Yeah, well, Johnson's the one I have. Yeah. Now, the second thing is, I have here a very interesting document. During the war, you didn't know it, but I was civil gas officer for the state of New Jersey. I had 2,000 gas officers, of which 500 were PhDs. For protection against radiological, bacteriological, and chemical warfare. Actually, I was in Washington and Pacific for the last 2.5 years, so New Jersey wasn't as well protected as I could. But I got the Army to spend $40,000, the only state in the Union that I know of that they spent, to run a gas school. And we had actually had in Princeton. Now, what we expected was, these 500 PhDs were from Merck and Sharp and Dohme and Esso and all the other industries, because that day New Jersey produced 1/6 of all the manufactured goods of the country. And we didn't expect the Germans to bombard New York or anything. Well, it was for sabotage. Yeah. And they came to the school to learn what would sabotage be like if we had it. But the other variant, and this is described in here, this is all the records of all people in it and all the things we did and so on. What we did, I don't know, 30 or 40 of them came to Princeton a number of weeks, maybe 5 weeks, every Saturday, and we made poison gas detectors. We had 200 kits for detecting poison gases. And then if the Germans had used poison gas, we were going to be flown over there to monitor and tell the people how to defend themselves. And when the war ended, at the Nuremberg trials, Alan Dulles, the head of OSS, was permitted to ask Goering one question, and he asked him, why didn't you use a chemical warfare that last month when you retreated across France? Goering looked at him and said, horses. And Dulles understood. Now, do you understand? The Germans were so incapacitated that they couldn't move material by lorries or trains, but only by horses. They knew we had poison gas, and if they used it, we would retaliate immediately. Now, men can work at about 80% efficiency with gas masks on, but horses couldn't. And they knew they would be at a disadvantage if they started the gas warfare. And that's why they didn't do it. But this is all recorded, not that, is it? But it's recorded near the way, whether it's interesting or not.
Oh, yes, that's very, one of the things I wanted to ask you about was that work during the war.
But I have some other things to tell you about Haber, too, and the war, for chemical warfare, and so on.
We'll get to that. And then these albums, did you want to talk to us about?
No, I have. I forget what was in here. I just had something else. I forget what it was. Oh, yeah, the Princeton thing. Here it is, you got it. It does exactly what you want. It's exactly what. And I didn't realize when I thought my picture was on it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But that's a report in 1950 by Hugh Taylor of what chemistry was like in the 20s and 30s and 40s, you see. That's exactly what you're asking. Yeah. From the Alumni Weekly,
Can we keep this copy?
Of course, yeah. I have the two copies. I have duplicates for each of you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, well, why don't we get started then with the tape, and we can.
Incidentally, I can tell you quite a number of stories about Einstein, quite a number of stories about Haber, several about Pauling, several about Arrhenius. Human interest stories, I think, is what you want.
Sure.
So, if you want. Well, probably, from my point of view, it would be simplest if you took it chronologically as on that list. I don't have the list downstairs, but you have this list here.
Yeah.
Isn't that a chronological? Yeah, that's the science list. I don't know. You do whatever way you want.
Well, we will go chronologically. I thought we could start. We'd like to ask you a little bit about what got you interested in science first, then go on from that to when you came to Princeton and what your undergraduate years were like, who you worked with here.
When I was 9 years old, I wrote to my brother Edwin, who was a doctor now, or he's dead now, but he's a doctor at Hopkins. In fact, they named the urology clinic after him, Edwin P. Alley Urology Clinic at Duke. And I wrote to Edwin, who was a sophomore at Princeton, "Dear Ed, I think I have a card somewhere. Please bring home sodium nitrate, carbon, and sulfur. That's the ingredients of gunpowder." And Edwin, being a pre-med, had sense enough not to. Mm-hmm. Instead, he brought home, he would be 1916. No, I was 12 by then, yeah. He brought home his qualitative analysis book that the sophomores were using there in Princeton. In those days, they spent the whole year in qualitative analysis, you see. And my father, who worked in New York, was sensible enough to go in and bring out all the chemicals that were required and set up down there. He lived in an old Dutch house with beams 4 feet square. You couldn't possibly burn it down. And I made a chemilab down in the cellar there with an asbestos mat and gas. And I carried out all the when I was 12 years old, I carried out all the qualitative analysis. I think I was younger. Let's see, 1917, 11 years old. I carried out all the qualitative analysis there in Clifton, New Jersey, in this old Dutch house, that the sophomores were carrying out at Princeton. Balanced all the chemical equations, thought I was having the most fantastic time in the world. So I was absolutely, there was no question I was going to be a chemist from then on.
Do you remember what book that was?
Baskerville and Kurtman. It was the standard qualitative analysis book, and I did all those barons downstairs and just had a wonderful time.
Was your father?
Now, I'm going to tell you later about why I became a teacher. That's different. Mm-hmm.
Was your father in the chemical industry? Or?
No, my father was in business. My father was a terribly interesting story, but I don't want to. Well, you can erase all the stuff. My father was originally a banker, and then they wanted to send him out to Chicago to take over their Chicago branch, but he didn't want to leave the East where his family was, and so he went and worked for the Mutual Life Insurance Company. I wouldn't say a menial job. He was in charge of 300 people. My great-grandfather had 500 people under him. He cut grass in a cemetery. Anyway, my father was in charge of the foreign department of the Mutual Life Insurance Company, which was quite a responsible job, apparently. But his life was his Sunday school. He was superintendent of the Clifton Reformed Church Sunday school, and he would come home 5 o'clock. That was very early in those days. He left New York at 4 o'clock. People worked until 5:30 or 6 in those days. And I can still see him coming up, taking off his coat and getting into the study that he had, a study about this big, where getting ready for the Sunday school work and working until midnight every night, and then going down on Sunday and running the Sunday school. Now, that Sunday school, every Sunday, had over 1,000 kids in it. He had 125 teachers. It was a major operation that he did, and he did this for 20 years. He went to New York every day and came back with he also had 2,000 chickens. I think by the time I was there, he only had about 500 chickens, but he had about 2,000 chickens. He used to take him into the Mark. Ethan were Edwin and Hubert, the three brothers, and they were called the Ethwinburg eggs, and he used to take them in. And I used to go up to the quarantine and get these huge eggs brought in from Denmark, where they used to grow have the chickens hatched from them. He just had a wonderfully happy life. All one brother, the genius of the family is Ethan, my brother. I don't know if you want to hear all this. The genius of the family is Ethan. He passed all the entrance exams to Princeton when he was 13. Has a letter from the registrar. "Why didn't you come? You were admitted." And he wrote, "Well, my folks don't think I'm mature enough. I'm going to stay home in Clifton and for another year and take Greek, Latin, and typewriting." He came to Princeton. I'll boast about him. And he was really extremely bright. When he graduated, he was salutatorian of his class. He got more prizes than anybody had gotten since 1883. And when there in Alexander Hall, I sat up there in the gallery looking down at my brother talking Latin for half an hour without any notes. I couldn't believe my big brother was talking. And then they began reading prizes in philosophy, in English, in mathematics. And every time it was Ethan Diaz, somebody jumped up. And he had six roommates in turn, one after another, and got his prizes. Well, now we come back to why about going into chemistry. In his, I think it was his sophomore year, he came home, I think it might have been Thanksgiving, and brought several of his classmates with him. Now, one of his classmates was Professor Smythe, Charles Smythe, mm-hmm. you see. And Professor Smythe came in. Now, I had started working on these chemicals, and in came this man, he was an undergraduate, the class of 1916, and Charlie Smythe was my brother. He walked in, and Ethan said, this man is going to be a chemist. And I looked at Charlie, and I said, he's going to be a chemist? Oh, I want to be like him. Isn't that amazing? A little realizing that he'd be I'd be working with him all the rest of my life, you see. That was the first time. Now, I'll jump ahead and tell you why I became a teacher. I graduated from Princeton. I was on crutches that last year. And so for my first year graduates, I wanted to go away to get my degree, but being on crutches, I thought it would be better. I had given an ample scholarship at Princeton. I keep on working here and then go away. And so it was in the fall after I graduated. I went up to Harvard to see if I could go up there and get my PhD. I went in to see Theodore W. Richards, T.W. Richards, who was the wisest, who was the top chemist of our country. He was the only one who got a Nobel Prize in chemistry from 1903 till 1928. He'd gotten his way back in 1916. And I had this letter of introduction, and I walked in and from Hugh Taylor, and I said, I would like to possibly come to Harvard to work. And he said, do you want to go into teaching or industry? I said, I think I want to go into teaching. This was an early morning, there in Harvard. And he said, well, this is an important decision for you, isn't it? I see you want to get to the football game, which I did. Go and come over to the house afterwards. So I went over to his house that night. And like all undergraduates, I stayed 3 hours there. They all should go at the end of the 30 minutes, you know. And he talked to me for 3 hours like a father would talk to his son. What it would be like to go into teaching, what it would be like to go into industry. And he said, I had applied for a Scandinavian American fellowship to study under Svante Arrhenius, the man that invented ionization. And he said, by all means, if you win that scholarship, go to the Nobel Institute and study for the year. And then come here to Harvard. I will be glad to have you come and work with me. Mm-hmm. Now, I laugh as I think, what would happen now if you went to Harvard or Yale or Princeton to the chairman of the department and said, I would like to come here and work. I had a good letter, of course, from Taylor. That fellow would say, well, go down the hallway to our assistant professor, Jim Smith takes care of our application, and we'll let you know next April. But here was this great man looking at me and said, we will be glad to have you come and study with me. And as I went out the door that night, I said, I want to be a teacher like him. Little did he know that 5 years later, I would share an office with his only son for 10 years in the Frick Laboratory. Bill Richards, his son, was there. And together, we played golf, we went together, all the time together. And little did he know that. Anyway, I got the scholarship. I went to Sweden, studied for the year, came back. When I came back, I was going to go to Harvard, but Princeton said, well, Hubert, the work you did there in Sweden is almost good for your PhD. Stay on until next June, and we can give you your PhD then. And we'll give you a Proctor Fellow. I already had a Proctor Fellow that I resigned because the other scholar. We'll give you a Proctor Fellow, and you'll get your degree next year. And so I stayed on and got my degree here at Princeton. And lucky, because if I hadn't, because if I'd gone to Harvard, it would have been 3 full years, and Richards died about 2 years later, and I would not have gotten my PhD and then my postdoc work until the middle 30s, and that was a depression, and nobody was hired in the university, and there's no question that my life would have been in industry and not university if I hadn't done it this way. But I came back, got my PhD, went out to Minnesota for a year on a national fellowship, went over to Germany for a year on an international fellowship, then came back to Princeton and stayed there for 42 years, and then retired 15 years ago.
Was your mother also very...
My mother was an unbelievable... I don't get anything to boast about my relatives. They're all... My mother was the most intelligent person I've ever known. Father died. He was very sick for 15 years. And then mother came down here to Princeton, lived in Palmer Square. Very independent she was. In her 80s, she attended 3 summer schools at Theological Seminary and took thick notes that would have put the ministers to shame. In fact, when she went and the interpreter Bibles came out, she went and ordered the bookman in Palmer said, "Well, I haven't ever heard of him." "Why, you must have, the theologian." "No, doctor, Mrs. Allier, the first one ever comes." Next week he came and said, "Oh, Mrs. Allier, you beat all the ministers out. They've been coming in droves ever since you were." Anyway, to show how bright she was the force of the family. To show how bright she was, when she was 82, the clerk of Clifton, New Jersey, came down to Princeton and said, Mr. Tilton it was, he said to Mrs. Allier, "I'm writing the history of Clifton, and unfortunately the records were burned up, and we have here 50 names. Can you tell us anything about these 50 people? And Mother gave them the day of birth and death of 42 of them. I can't even tell you when my own father and mother died. Maybe he asked, well, born April 15th, 1887, and died June 7, 1932. So, you know. Well, the question was, she right? 6 months later, he sent my mother, Ellis, he said, "We found a duplicate record set up in the Patterson Courthouse. Here's what you said, and here's what they said." She was exactly right on 38 of them, and she was wrong on 1 count out of 4 of them. And instead of being proud, she was furious. She says, "The idea, Mamie Aspel, the 28th of April. She always celebrated her birthday on the 15th of April. Old Dr. Vanderman was so close to he did." We never looked up the phone number. What's Mr. Proch's number? Well, Clifton 5732. Oh, no, on June 17, 1916, that was changed too. And it was unbelievable. And when Ethan went into law and Edwin went into medicine, and I went into chemistry, she immediately became an authority in the field before we went in and told us all about it. The year I was invited to Hawaii, I went over to my mother. "Well, you were there to see Queen Kapi'olani's grandniece." "Who? Queen? Why, Hubert, don't you know anything about the history of Hawaii?" She'd read it all off. And then she went and she traced our family history of the Alliers back to 1680 when they came over here. And then wrote to the mayor of Amsterdam, who was a Daye, who came from the same root about 8 generations back. And when a lawyer was over, a woman lawyer was here, visiting my brother up in Montclair, she said, "By the way, I've had a correspondence. The mayor told me to look up a lady, a Mrs. Allier down at Princeton. Do you know her by any chance?" And so he sent Mother all the Allier family history, Daye it really was, back to something like 900. But they only had a single name. And then they were changed to Aif, the whole cloche. And then they married in barons or something. They became Dayes. And he had the whole history of it because one of them got a Legion of Honor from the Charlie III. When they do, they actually trace your genealogy back as far as they can. And that's his mother. She was she was the driving force of the family and the inspiration for all of us, you know. And when I had polio and she took care of me, they used to take me up to... they used to put me on an ambulance. If you want to know the goodness of human nature, go to the Grand Central and have them put you in a chair and wheel you through the Grand Central and see the kindly people all looking pitifully at you and say, "Isn't it too bad?" And they'd put me on the train, take me up to the Back Bay, take me out on a stretcher to 234 Marlboro, where Dr. Lovett took care of me. He was taking care of Franklin D. Roosevelt at the same time, 1923. Roosevelt had his in 31, was was still being taken care of by he was the leading authority when they had it in 1917 in New York. They went up and brought Lovett down to New York to handle it. So he was the leading authority. And my brother was at Hopkins, on the staff of Medical Hopkins. And they said, oh, take him up to Lovett in Boston. I'm sure he was the one that gave me back my strength. Yeah. And I was right out of luck. Mother wouldn't let me play football. I loved to play, but because I have no ear on this side. It's all carved out. Yeah. And she was afraid if I got hit on this side, it'd be deaf. She said, you're probably right. So I used to play sandlot for what it was worth. I forget what I was going to say. At my age, it's very bad, you know, Jeff. You forget things so easily. I forget names, and I forget three things. I forget names and places. I forget what the other thing is.
Well, you mentioned it.
Oh yes, I was going to say I was third from the top in handball in Princeton as an undergraduate. And then I had polio, and then I had to go down to the gym. For 3 years, I used to have to swim 2 hours a day, 7 days a week. Never want to swim again. So if I go to hell, that's what I'm going to have to be swimming all of my life.
So that you fell ill, when was that, your junior year at Princeton, then, if it was 1923?
Yeah, but I came back September, from a senior year, and I was going to room my roommate. I had taken a room, and he hadn't come back early. I was all alone. I used to go down to the infirmary. I had this awful headache, but I had no fever. In fact, they fired the doctor who hadn't spotted it, because they had two cases of polio in Princeton at the time, and they wouldn't take me. They said, nothing wrong with you. Go on back. And I was all night. I would say it was a terrible night. Then I went down to the chem lab, and I was going to build something. And it was a tall thing. I was going to, reaching up to put it, my arm couldn't go up. Mm-hmm. And I realized something was wrong, so I better go back there. And on the way to the knee gave away, and I fell. And I told them. Then they tried my babushka, and they saw that I had polio. Mm-hmm. And then they had Dr. Draper come down and do a lumbar puncture and found that I had. But that was my the first week of my senior year. Mm-hmm. And I caught it going. I was a counselor at a boys' camp up in Connecticut that summer, and I couldn't catch it there because no one had that. But I went into the first chemical show in New York City, and I undoubtedly said I must have caught it then. Mm-hmm. It was very, very hot. I had a heavy coat on. It was hot, and they said you must have been in contact with somebody. So that's what chemistry gave me, my polio. Today, I'm beginning to feel a little. I have only one muscle in this leg instead of four. It's putting pressure on my knees. My knees are getting very weak. Mm. In my Christmas card this year, I said, Mother Nature is collapsing out to me. My knees are getting weak, but my morals are still strong. I wish it were the other way around. I have so much more fun.
Did you have to take a year off then, or?
I spent that year learning how to type. So I can type. Yeah. I can type 140 words a minute. They're the wrong words. And I studied a lot of physical chemistry. Mm-hmm. Dr. Taylor helped me a great deal. He sent me books and things that from Princeton, and I studied. And I didn't lose one bit. And at the time, I thought, isn't it awful? A year of my life is gone. Mm-hmm. It was nothing in comparison to the 60 years that are still going to go. And I always tell my boys, because you can't record this, but I'll tell my boys, the best year of life, I have to have it over here. I would include polio with all the things that has left, left me with, because I know that it changed my life completely. It gave me time to have a philosophy of life. This above all other things, to thine own self be true, then thou canst not be false to any other man. Mm-hmm. Or what is on the campus in Antioch College, there's a stone in which is chiseled the commencement words of the of Horace Mann, the first president, who at the commencement said, I beseech you to give heed to these my parting words. Be ashamed to die until you have won some victory for humanity. And that's what I learned that year when I had polio. And I wanted to leave the world better off because I'd been in it. And I'm sure I was such a headlong guy, I would have never stopped to think these things through as I did. So I'm very grateful for it. strangely to say.
It's good to know that one can learn from an experience like that. It's certainly better than just being sorry that it didn't happen. I wonder if we could go back to ask you some questions about the professors you had during your years at Princeton as an undergraduate.
The 20s were divided into two five-year sections. Mm-hmm. They were quite different. The first 5 years, Leroy McKay, this is told about this in here, but I might add a little bit of that. Leroy McKay was chairman, and analysis was very important. In those days, you see, companies didn't have the research team, and the metallurgists and so on, they had to analyze for the percentage of manganese and percentage of things in the alloys they were buying and selling and so on. And so chemists would make additional money by there were three branches, very sharp branches of chemistry, which are fused now. There was inorganic, there was organic, there was physical, and there's analytical. Now, in the first 5 years in Princeton, 20 to 25, analytical was the important thing, and that was Leroy McKay, descendant of Alan Poe, wonderful gentleman, and his assistant, Howell Thurman. Mm-hmm. I can say something about each of these later on. The second group, where the organic group, was Laura Jones. Not very much information about him now, but he was a nitrogen chemist, a great renown. Everett Wallace and was one of his students. And a professor, and Randolph Major, who was later the director of research of Merck and Company. Those were his two most important students. In inorganic, there wasn't very much. There was Alan Menges, M-E-N-Z-I-E-S, Betty Menges' father, mm-hmm. Who didn't do very much research, but was a fine teacher. He taught general chemistry. That Turkovich took over. Mm-hmm. He was a very fine teacher, but not really. He and Taylor were sort of trying to fighting it out to who would be. And then finally, there was this was the first 5 years. There was George Hewlett. Now George Hewlett was a very capable chemist. He was one of Wilson's preceptor guys, you see, and he had made a name for himself in electrochemistry. And he had brought Hugh Taylor. Those are the two things he had done. This great thing was bringing Hugh Taylor here way back in 1915 or so, I think, Hugh Taylor came. Then it was interrupted to the war and then came back again. Mm-hmm. Now, George, when I was a senior on crutches, and I didn't use my crutches too much, just enough so I could get a car on campus. He got me to measure his standard cells, and he had made these standards sort of give a standard voltage. I forget what it was, 1.183, something like that. And these cells he had made back in 1905. And here was 1925, 20 years later. And I was to measure, they were mercury cells, contained mercury compounds, and they react with water and deteriorate. And I was to measure, he had maybe 300 cells. And I was very careful to measure them and find out the ones that weren't any good, why they weren't any good. Because in those days, standard voltage was an important thing. Mm-hmm. These standard cells is what he was famous for. And so I used to... He was also famous for... Well, I would not go into detail on that. Rate of dissolving and stuff. And so that whole year, I must have put in at least 100 hours of work measuring these old cells that he had that were now 20 years old to see if they had deteriorated or not. And then he got a stroke and became incapacitated. He could still lecture a little bit, but not too much. And that's when Dr. Taylor soared into prominence and became... And so that would be about 1925, just when I was graduating. You see, Dr. Taylor took over and really made a name for Princeton in the field of catalysis.
Just one second, please.